It's time for a healthy breakfast.
Which is the number one chocolate
drink? Two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderfully fresh.
That's a spicy
one of the main takeaways is just to be a little bit weary. The new hot superfood that's not only healthy and gluten-free and, it's also solving poverty and hunger all over the world. And, you know, I think to be really weary of those kinds of claims.
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
And I'm Tom Philpott, food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones Magazine.
I'm Raj Patel from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs. And today's secret ingredient is quinoa. So if you'd like to know how to cook and prepare the most delicious, high-protein, sustainably traded cereal from the Altiplano, you're listening to the wrong show. We are here to talk about the kinds of things that hide behind the ingredients that you're curious about. So if you want recipes, we'll probably have a link on our podcast page to some other show that will indulge you. But for right now, we're going to talk to Tanya Kirsten, who is a researcher, an activist, and author. She's the research coordinator at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First, and she's the author of Grabbing Power, The New Struggles for Land, Food, and Democracy in Northern Honduras, which came out of her solidarity work with Honduran popular movements in the 2009 coup. But we're talking to her today about her work on quinoa, and you can find more on her 2013 Common Dreams article on our website. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's dive right in, Tanya. Why are we talking about quinoa in the first place? I mean, a decade ago, it seemed like this stuff was just a mysterious bean that sat on the aisle somewhere that no one ate. And now all of a sudden, it's like quinoa this, quinoa that. Whence quinoa?
Well, it's interesting. I'm actually, I was sort of surprised to be invited today to talk about quinoa because I had kind of assumed that no one really cared anymore. There was kind of a boom, I guess, in 2003. The same sort of boom that we talk about in terms of the production of quinoa, there was sort of a boom in media interest and fascination and curiosity in quinoa, often termed, the newest trendy superfood in high demand in the global north because of its, high nutritional properties, high levels of protein and calcium and iron and fiber, and also as a gluten-free food that's been very appealing to, folks on a gluten-free diet and also for vegetarians and vegans looking for, plant-based proteins. So, of course, when we talk about demand for something, that you've never heard of, it's not something that happens, magically. It's not created by, all of a sudden consumers just want something totally that was once totally foreign to them. The demand for quinoa is really something that was created and pushed for primarily by farmers in the Andean region who were growing quinoa primarily for subsistence and were able to make connections with companies, sort of social justice-oriented type of companies in the U.S. and Europe who were interested in helping poor farmers and sort of mobilize those kind of alternative food markets in order to create a better livelihood for themselves. And so what began as kind of a niche health food primarily consumed by, hippies in the U.S. in the 80s, grew in popularity as more and more, people found out about it and were interested in, sort of exotic healthy foods.
Can you talk through for a second, Tanya, the sort of way that quinoa developed in the Andean region, the way that it sort of the original agricultural system that you've written about so fascinatingly, and how it developed in the sort of highlands area in relation to other kinds of agriculture going on in the lowlands?
I mean, I think what's so amazing about the Andes, it's such a complex, such a patchwork of complex ecosystems and agroecosystems and cultures. Quinoa really developed in one of the most, we'll say remote, although that's a relative term, but most remote, pretty inhospitable parts of the Andes where, people will often say, right, nothing else grows but quinoa in terms of agricultural products in the southern Altiplano. This is a region that, historically was primarily a pastoral region, meaning, herding of animals, llamas historically, huge caravans of llamas. Before the Spanish conquest, you had caravans of, 10,000 or 20,000 llamas moving through the Altiplano. And quinoa developed as sedentary agriculture developed as a very, as a crop that was very adapted to a very dry region with very little rainfall, very saline, sandy, volcanic soils in a region that, after the Spanish conquest was pretty much ignored, except for some mining, but pretty much ignored by the Spanish, by the colonizers, because it wasn't fit for growing any of the crops that the Spaniards liked to consume. You couldn't grow wheat there. You couldn't grow barley there. You couldn't even grow potatoes there. So it's a very very hardy crop. That's highly nutritious and really, a pillar of food security in the southern Altiplano.
And there was
the beginning of agriculture,
right? And there was a symbiosis between llama farm, llama sort of herding, and quinoa, wasn't there?
Yeah, they really go completely hand in hand. Especially in the quinoa is grown in many different regions, and it's grown on the coast of South America. It's grown in sort of subtropical montane regions. It's grown around Lake Titicaca, which is thought to be the center of origin of quinoa. But the reason I talk so much about the southern Altiplano of Bolivia is because this has really been the heart of the recent quinoa boom, and where the one very prized variety of quinoa is grown. It's known as royal quinoa or quinoa real. Yes, and in this region, llamas and quinoa have always gone together since the domestication of quinoa as a food crop in the southern Altiplano region, with pastoralism being the main activity. People mostly focusing on, raising llama herds for food and fiber, exchanging llama meat and fiber with, people from other parts of the Andes for fruits and vegetables and fish and things like that. And then growing quinoa only on very, very small hillside plots, the size of which was determined primarily by how much, each family of the community needed for its subsistence. So if you had a big family, you would grow more quinoa. If you had a small family, you would grow less. historically, the quinoa plots have been on the hillsides, on very labor-intensive terraces, and the llamas really dominating the plains, the flat areas, and the of course the you know llama you know manure was used to then fertilize the small quinoa plots, which was you know very important considering there's the soils are lacking in, you know, they're not very fertile soils, so they really depend on that, you know, reintroduction of organic matter.
Right. So, Tanya, one more question for me. So, you had this system of sort of integrated agriculture, llamas and quinoa, that went along more or less interrupted by colonialization, by in the post-colonial era. And then, am I understanding correctly that in the 70s and 80s, and maybe even a little before that, you start getting out-migration from the area, right, based on new policies, sort of neoliberal policies that were coming down the pike?
Yeah, I mean, I think migration, it's a very difficult thing. I mean, probably anywhere, but especially in the Andes, to pin down because populations have always been extremely mobile. And, you know, dual, triple residency is something that's, you know, part of the, you know, way of life for most people. And there have been multiple sort of important moments of changes in migratory patterns in Bolivia. So, you know, one of them was after the 1950s. social revolution, where people were, you know, basically no longer slaves and didn't have to be slaves on haciendas and in mines and could go wherever they wanted. So you had a huge transformation, people, you know, moving to the city, especially. In the 70s and 80s, I think you have another important shift in migration that comes from, you know, a big, you know, El Nino drought in 1982-1983. There was also the, you know, privatization of the mines in 1985, in which a lot of folks left. You know, left the mine, like 50,000 miners, I think, were laid off with the privatization of the state-owned mines in 1985. And many of them, you know, went back to agriculture. And where, you know, as I said, with the patterns of double, triple residency, many of them still had their land, even though they had been engaged in mining for a long time. And so they were able to go back to their land in, you know, quinoa-growing communities and go back to growing quinoa, you know, as a sort of safety net for them. And many, many other miners also moved into the tropical areas to plant coca. You know, so in a way, there's sort of an interesting kind of parallel there. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, you know, but coca and quinoa is like two of these crops that didn't suffer the dramatic erosion of farm gate prices in the neoliberal era that other crops did, you know, so you just couldn't, you know, grow potatoes and survive. But you could grow coca and you could grow increasingly, you know, you could grow quinoa.
Right. Because other crops like wheat and things like that were suddenly subjected to foreign competition, driving down prices, but there was no real competition for quinoa or limited competition for coca.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that was, I guess, sort of Bolivia's comparative advantage, right?
Yeah.
Agriculturally speaking. You know, the wheat, the domestic wheat production was really decimated decades before with huge dumping of U.S., you know, subsidized U.S. wheat in the form of food aid. And Bolivia was the first recipient of PL 480 food aid shipments. right after its revolution. So you can see sort of what the political kind of geopolitical motivation might have been there. But then, yeah, in the 80s and 90s, Bolivia also joined sort of some like regional agreements, especially the Andean Community of Nations. And as like the weakest partner in those agreements, really, you know, suffered and began to see a lot of cheap imports from neighboring countries. So, you know, potatoes and onions and carrots and, you know, things that peasants were producing were coming in cheaper from Peru, from Chile, from Argentina.
So around this time, you get farmers in this region that we're talking about here organizing to find foreign markets for quinoa, and it's through these alternative trade networks like Fair Trade. Is that right?
Yes. Yep. This is how it really begins. Sort of the beginnings of Fair Trade and the beginnings of of quinoa exports kind of go hand in hand.
Well, I'm not sure if we want to go this far ahead, but I'm really curious about you. You said that you were surprised because you didn't think a lot of people were going to be interested in this topic anymore. And I was wondering, was there some like backlash to this mass production of quinoa and distribution in the United States, and people cared for a while and now they don't? And what can you kind of set the scene for us a little bit on that front?
Sure. Well, you know, I think it was, let me think, like 2011, 2012, when some, not to beat up on reporters, but I think sometimes one reporter will do a story and then all of a sudden, like, you know, 50 stories come out on the same thing. And so there was one New York Times article in particular that came out, and I have some friends who worked on this piece as fixers and stuff, and they feel really like they've been unfairly blamed for some of the wrong assumptions that were that were highlighted in this article. A lot of the assumptions made in this sort of first article of like looking at what the impacts are of quinoa expansion in Bolivia were then reproduced a number of times in a lot of other articles. And, you know, one of the main assumptions and one that a lot of consumers in the U.S. and in Europe picked up on is that, quinoa has gotten so expensive that the farmers who produce quinoa can no longer afford to eat it, which, you know, understandably, it's like a very very compelling sort of heartbreaking situation if that's the case. But it seemed to be based on some, I think, mistaken kind of interpretation of data. So, for example, you know, if you ask a farmer, you know, what percentage of your harvest did you used to keep for your own subsistence before, like 10 years ago, and what percentage do you keep now? You know, and that may have decreased from 50% to, 5%. But of course, if you used to grow a quarter acre of quinoa and now you grow, 30, that would affect percentage that you hold on to for subsistence. So, but that is one part. I think there are a lot of negative impacts in terms of, which we can get into consumption, in terms of, ecological impacts. But that one has been a particularly persistent, I think, myth, is that the quinoa farmers can't afford to eat quinoa. And that's one I'm always, always asked about, just repeatedly. And it's also one that really irritates people in Bolivia.
So it's not really true then?
Well, it's not really true, but of course, I'm always accused of using the word complex too much, but the reality is very complex. You know, because if you're a quinoa farmer and you've seen your income go up dramatically, you know, one thing you're able to do is, you know, if you were eating a pretty monotonous diet of quinoa every day before, now you're able to eat other kinds of things.
Right.
You know, and for, that can be for better or worse, of course. And, you know, I think the quinoa defenders all always say, oh, well, now they can eat more fruits and vegetables, which is true. But, you know, of course, they can also eat, you know, refined wheat products and junk food. And their kids are asking for junk food, you know, and pressuring them to buy them candy bars and sugared yogurts and things like that. So there's that on the one hand. But I think there's also another sort of myth that goes along with this about quinoa and the quinoa boom, which is that quinoa farmers are this sort of homogeneous blob that all do the same thing and respond to, you know, experience reality the same way, which is, of course, not true, because, you know, some quinoa farmers they really value quinoa as part of their indigenous traditions and really recognize its, you know, its nutritional and cultural value, you know, as part of their food sovereignty and cultural sovereignty. But then there are other farmers, and especially sort of more like newcomers to quinoa farming, who got into the game somewhat more recently and were a little bit more disconnected from their indigenous identity and probably have more urbanized and westernized diets, who don't eat quinoa as much, you know, or at all.
Right.
But so, Tanya, I mean, I think one of the reasons why people think, you know, there's this tragedy in Bolivia about, well, you know, us hippies in Germany or wherever it is, demanding quinoa is causing suffering in the you know, in the benighted countries of Latin America. Excuse me. Is because there's the idea that this was the one crop that was virtuous, that did come through these fair trade networks, and therefore was sort of immune from the kinds of marketing pressures that, you know, that obtain for the wheat products and the processed food that you're talking about there.
Right.
But and I also think that there's in the back of people's minds there is this model of the quinoa farmer as someone who's kind of like a small-scale American wheat farmer, where you go out and you have quinoa fields, and they, you know, they strafe the fields with their hands, and they caress the quinoa as it germinates, and there's only quinoa in the field, and there's only one harvest a year, and that sort of assumption, as you say, is wrong. I mean, there are these, you know, the integrations with farmers, but there's also the quinoa that grows as intercropped with other things, and there's the quinoa that forms part of systems that are not about the commodity markets, but they're about something called IU. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, because it seems like that assumption about what it is that you're growing the food for and the conditions under which you're growing it is a far more difficult and intractable assumption to pluck from people's heads.
Right. I think that the IU is, I'm trying to think what I want to say first. Just one quick comment before going into the IU about consumption is that I think it is important to recognize, you know, who has not had access to quinoa, and that's been, you know, the rural and urban poor who are not quinoa producers. You know, and a lot of people inside and outside Bolivia have talked about, you know, how the high price of quinoa has actually been a barrier. And even though actually quinoa consumption in Bolivia has increased, it appears that this is not a result of my research, but sort of what I suspect is that it's increased primarily among more affluent sectors. So in terms of the IU, the IU is an indigenous indigenous community that has remained primarily intact, I think closest to what it was before the conquest, in the southern Altiplano. And again, the reason for that is that the Spaniards didn't really want to totally colonize that area because it had not, it didn't have much to offer. And so the indigenous communities really maintained, you know, their tradition of rotating leadership, of rotating indigenous authorities, which were typically both a man and a woman together, who assigned, you know, as I said before, like different, you know, different families within the indigenous community would farm an amount of land based on, you know, based on their needs. And this was allocated by the indigenous authority, who also regulated the system of crop rotation, which in this area is known as mantos, which, you know, I think, you know, most of the listeners probably understand crop rotation. You know, you move your field around so that you're not depleting soil fertility in a particular piece of land. And this, you know, I think it's important for us. We tend to think of sustainability as something that's primarily technical, but I think it's important to recognize that, you know, sustainability is very intimately connected to the social and cultural forms, so such as the Andean IU and the role of the traditional indigenous authorities in regulating production, and this is something with the commercialization of quinoa in this region and also with out-migration, right? It's difficult to sustain cultural traditions when there are no people. And this is one of the big tensions in this area. You know, we congratulate quinoa for bringing people back to the region, but then it's, you know, bringing people back under what rationality? And typically, folks who are coming back to the area have more of a sort of entrepreneurial, commercial rationality, motivated more by the profit motive than the folks who, you know, remained in the area and continued, you know, recognizing, respecting traditional practices and authorities over time. And so, you know, this dichotomy doesn't always hold 100% of the time, but I think, you know, what I've seen in talking to people is that, you know, the folks who have stayed, who have been living long term in these territories, have a different, a more intimate relationship with the land, you know, understandably, and with this, the idea of what it can sustainably produce and why, you know, as in for profit or for, you know, sustaining your family and culture. As opposed to, you know, some of the folks who saw prices increasing and decided to go back and grow quinoa and expand quinoa primarily for profit. And that's, you know, so there have been a lot of tensions, you know, I think between these two rationalities. And you also have folks coming in from the city who went to school, maybe in college, maybe even, and were able to work in some government post. They speak Spanish, you know, and they don't necessarily, when they go back to their home communities, they don't necessarily respect the elders. And, you know, this is something we can relate to in the U.S., right? They're educated. They don't really respect the traditional knowledge of their elders or, you know, follow their the traditional norms about land use.
Tanya, you know, this scenario that you're setting up, I keep thinking to the way that oil production is done on the coast in Texas. And you have a lot of guys kind of leaving their home, going down to work in the refineries and then going back. And the living conditions down there are horrendous. And I was wondering if you could just kind of like set up a little bit about what the living conditions are like what is the culture like? And are the people who are working in the fields bringing their families down? Are they shifting the way that the economy is set up there, or are they leaving and they're working for a season and then going back?
Yeah, this is one thing that is very stark if you go to this region. It's funny, I live in La Paz, in the capital, La Paz, and I'll often get people saying, oh, I'm like a reporter or a PhD student, I'm coming through La Paz, can you tell me where I can visit some quinoa farms around there, you know, to sort of study the quinoa boom? I'm like, well, you have like about a 15-hour journey ahead of you, actually. But if you do, you know, make it out there, you know, one thing, if you're imagining that the quinoa boom has brought all sorts of prosperity and, you know, and roads and schools and, you know, what have you, then you're sorely disappointed, because first of all, you know, you need to rent a Land Rover to get there, because there are really very few paved roads. And then what you see is a what looks like just ghost towns, you know, sort of completely broken down, what looked totally abandoned, like adobe houses. And I mean, I think there are some new things, but what people have, there's been a sort of an extractive, I think, mentality of a lot of folks that, you know, you go there, you grow the quinoa, you sell it, and then you take the wealth somewhere else. You invest it maybe in your, you know, some other urban entrepreneurial activity, or, you know, it's not necessarily reinvested in the community. You know, with that said, I think that the communities, the farmers, you know, recognize in these areas that this is happening, that it's a problem. And, you know, what I write about in the article you had mentioned earlier is how they're trying to combat this. And it's obviously very difficult, but, you know, they're coming together, you know, for community assemblies, and they're beginning to require that anyone who farms, not just someone who lives in the area, has to attend these assemblies, and that they have to abide by, you know, certain norms that are established by the community. So one of them, and they're different, you know, in different, you know, I'm sort of using the word IU and the word community interchangeably here, but, you know, so one of the norms might be that you're required to have a residence in the community. You have to have a house. It like, seems really basic, but there are a lot of folks who are just coming down and sleeping in the back of their pickup truck for the, you know, the planting and the harvesting, really just, you know, coming down a couple times a year, or not coming down at all and just making a phone call, you know, on your cell phone from La Paz with some of the people who live there and saying, you know, I'll pay you this much to harvest my quinoa. You know, so trying to deal with this dynamic of absenteeism and extractivism so that you can see some tangible effects of the quinoa boom in terms of improving quality of life in the area.
So I think we should explain that during the out-migration period, a lot of people moved out into the cities of Bolivia, but retained ancestral land, sort of vaguely defined rights to ancestral land. Mm-hmm. And then when the quinoa boom happened, they, you know, as part of this sort of proffered opportunity, move back in fairly significant numbers. Is that correct? Or not, yeah, move back, yeah, but sort of reclaimed the land to plant quinoa and then didn't necessarily live in the area. But descendants,
yeah, exactly,
of indigenous farmers that are now pretty citified.
So, yeah, it's pretty fascinating aspect of this whole thing, I think, because, you know, I think, you know, people have asked me, for instance, if there's, you know, if if what's happening in this area is like a land grab. And, you know, obviously that sort of depends on how you define land grabbing, but certainly not in the conventional sense, because you can't access land in this region unless you are indigenous and have membership ties to a particular indigenous community. But, you know, that's, so on the one hand, you know, there's not like a bunch of, you know, Brazilians or something coming in and grabbing up land in the southern Altiplano for quinoa, like they're doing with soy lowlands of Bolivia. But, you know, on the other hand, yeah, you have folks who do have a link, you know, to an indigenous community, but it may not even be, you know, they may have been born in the city and never even set foot in it, you know, maybe from a previous generation.
Right.
And they may not even, you know, speak Aymara or Quechua and the indigenous languages. And they may not have any idea where the land was that their, you know, parents or grandparents, you know, used to farm. Several generations ago. So obviously that causes a lot of confusion and, you know, mistrust and tensions and, you know, arguments. You know, there are even things, intrafamiliar issues where, you know, one brother, you know, left for the city for, you know, 30 years and one stayed. And then the you know, urban brother wants to come back and, you know, claim half the land that's been farmed, you know, by the other sibling through a lot of hardships probably for many years. And typically what will be done is that by the community and the family is that, you know, that sibling who had left a claim on that land will be recognized and they will get, you know, half of that land, you know, to be able to farm. But yeah, it's very complicated.
You know, I'm wondering, like, where do you see the problems, the main problems surrounding quinoa now in the U.S.? I mean, it's funny because you spend time, you're in Minnesota now, and then you also go back to Bolivia. And when you come back to the States, you go to a regular grocery store, you know, what is like, you just shake your head like, seriously, people, like, are, this is where we're at right now. Or kind of how do you negotiate the what's going on in the world of quinoa now?
Well, it's interesting because all of this stuff I'm talking with you about now is from my field work, my research that I did in 2012, 2013, primarily, really at the height of the, you know, of the quinoa boom. And so, you know, just before this conversation, I was busy, like, looking at some articles about, like, what's happened in the last 2 years, because a lot has changed. You know, mostly, you know, what was totally predictable, we all knew would happen, is that the boom has gone bust.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in part because I think there's sort of a plateauing of consumer demand. And, you know, you're hearing all sorts of, like, you know, what's the new trendy superfood, like, which I gather is now teff from East Africa.
Oh, boy.
teff is the new quinoa. I've seen that headline a bunch of times. but also because there are now, I think I read, 68 quinoa-producing countries.
Right.
Which to varying degrees, I think some of those are not at large scale commercial productions, sort of still the trial stage. But, you know, Peru, which is a more industrialized, more economically advanced country, has really ramped up production and surpassed Bolivia in the last couple of years as the largest quinoa exporter.
Hmm.
And so, you know, all of those factors have led to a pretty dramatic collapse of farm gate prices for quinoa.
So we're talking about how much, like 50%?
More than that?
Yeah, more than that. Wow. So that, let's see, right now, compared to the peak of quinoa prices in like 2013, 2014, it's less than a third.
Wow.
So 300, so at its peak was roughly $315 per quintal, which is 100 pounds, so $315, and it's now $85.
Wow. And so I would assume that still close to 100% of quinoa production in the global market is from those countries in that region, right, the Andean countries. There still isn't significant U.S. production. I mean, they're trying it out in a couple of places, but there still isn't significant production, right?
There isn't, no, significant production, but there's significant investment in research and variety trials and things like that. So, you know, about a year, like 2 years ago now, you know, there was this big research conference at Washington State University, quinoa research conference, and I went, and there were like five quinoa farmers were brought up through Andean Naturals had come up with the money to bring, you know, otherwise there wouldn't have been any quinoa farmers there from Bolivia, but Andean Naturals came up with the funds to bring them up, you know, and then we visited this, you know, experimental quinoa we'll say plot. And it was something like, you know, 5,000 acres or something, just crazy. And they couldn't wrap their brains around it.
Wow.
Of course, just looking out, you know, at these massive monocultures when I don't know what the exact average is for a quinoa farm in the southern Altiplano, but like a large... like a large quinoa farm, we're talking about maybe 50 hectares.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know, like less than 150 acres still for like a really pretty large scale.
So most of the price drop is driven by ramping up production in Peru. Is that correct?
That appears to be the case. And then, you know, of course, the area of production has also dramatically increased in Bolivia over the last 5 years, between, you know, doubled and tripled, you know, so that's also contributed to the price drop. But of course, yields are also declining, particularly in Bolivia, where the soils are very, you know, fragile, and there's not a lot of effort, you know, there's no real state extension support for this, but there's some NGO support for soil conservation, but it's pretty minimal.
So talk us through the way that this boom has changed the agricultural practices in this region that we're talking about, in the Altiplano, where you see quinoa moving off the hillsides onto the ground. You see llamas being removed, and how that's affected the ecology of production.
Yeah, I think that this, to me, is the most worrisome aspect of the quinoa boom, and. You know, what I always said was like, well, we don't know what's going to happen first, the market bust, or that, you know, the soils become completely inert, because in the main quinoa producing departments of Oruro and Potosi, you already have levels of 70 to 90% desertification.
Wow.
So, and that's obviously, that's not only due to quinoa, but it just goes to show how precarious these soils are if they're not properly cared for. So, you know, as you point out, the main factor that transformed production in this area was the introduction of tractors. And it's, you know, whereas once your production was defined by how much you, what your needs were as a family, Now the amount that you produce is based on how many tractors you have.
Wow. Major change.
Yep. Huge change. And access to that capital has come, I think, it seems like from two different places. One, if you had a herd of llamas and sheep and you were primarily pastoralists, if you had a large herd, you were able to basically sell your animals to invest in tractors and expand quinoa. Or if you had, if you were working in, mining or some sort of urban commercial activity, then maybe the capital came from those other economic sectors and you were able to buy a tractor or several in order to expand production. And, what's happened in terms of land tenure is that, these are not areas where people have, where private property exists, because it's legally their communal territories. But there's been kind of a de facto sort of privatization, sort of enclosure of communal lands due to the transfer, transformation from a mainly communal land use of herding to a more private land use of agriculture, if that makes sense, So basically you're able to expand into this kind of Wild West, agricultural frontier of communal grazing lands if you had the tractors to do it.
Right. And one thing that happens in markets like this that are based on global price fluctuations and overproduction and things like that is that maybe in a normal market, when the price drops, then people say, well, there's less demand for quinoa. I'm going to grow less of it. But in agricultural commodity markets, oftentimes a price drop will be a signal to farmers to produce more in an attempt to make up on volume what they're losing on price. And when everyone does the same thing, you get into this spiral of sort of downward spiral. Is that happening there in quinoa country? Are people saying prices are low, so I better intensify production? Or are they pulling back?
So that's interesting. Yeah, that's also something, that's more, it's a very, it's a capitalist assumption, right, that farmers will grow less if the price goes down. But what peasants can often do is just exploit themselves even harder just to grow more. Because I haven't been watching it very closely in the last year, and with the really recent collapse in prices in the last 6 months, I'm not entirely sure what's going on right now. I suspect that to some degree, this is a good thing because the people who came in more opportunistically are probably not going to continue doubling down on that, because mineral prices are high, so you can make a lot from mining, and there's a construction boom, so you can make a lot from working in construction, and people have a little bit more income under this government, so you can make a lot from selling consumer goods. So I suspect that that might reduce the pressure a little bit, which is always a double-edged sword because, of course, we want farmers to get a good price for their crop. They're still getting triple what a potato farmer gets.
Right.
growing quinoa. But there's also a greater distance from markets, and so transportation costs are higher, and the processing is much more elaborate. Processing needs for quinoa are much more elaborate. It's not totally clear, but I think this is sort of the crux of the issue, right, is that this thing has mostly just been left up to the whims of the free market. And there's been really very little, if any at all, attempts on from the government to intervene, to like regulate supply, to say what can we sustainably produce. Let's only produce that much and not more. There's really been none of that. You can't entirely blame the Bolivian government, although I think there is a huge lack of political will to do that, because it's difficult. It's a difficult thing to do politically. It's easier to just say, oh, you have good global price, you're happy.
Right.
Just stay out of it. But also Bolivia is a country that was really brutally neoliberalized through structural adjustment policies. And so, state capacity to do a lot of things that we think maybe they should do is fairly limited.
So then, Tanya, I mean, we're already, as you say, you've seen this headline that TEF is the new quinoa. Mm-hmm. And at some point, there'll be a new TEF, and there will be,
right.
And we've seen these cycles before, and I imagine the question that you often get asked then by consumers of quinoa or other exotic cereals is, all right, so what do I do? Do I buy this or do I not buy this? Or maybe what I should do is buy llama as well, so that we can have a demand for llama and a demand for quinoa. What do you say to someone who comes with that kind of that question of, so how do I vote with my fork here?
Oh, man, I guess I'd probably say it's complicated, which is not a satisfying answer, I understand. I think, it's interesting because from the quinoa farmers, what they tell me is they say, oh, why don't you tell people in the U.S. to consume more llama products, exactly what you just said.
Wow,
so that we'll also receive, get more remuneration for that activity. And, and they say, don't they understand that quinoa and llama go together? You can't have one without the other. Of course, I think that's like still a very kind of free market, way to look at it, is just increase demand for llamas. And that's also the way that, for instance, the World Bank, unsurprisingly, is looking at it. They've just started this year a quinoa llama promotion project.
So what exactly, if you don't mind, would we be buying? Is it like llama milk or llama llama meat? Llama
sweaters?
Llama sweaters? Llama purses? What are llamas for? How do we consume llama?
Yeah, I mean, one way that I really enjoy consuming llama is as sausage and salami.
Yum.
Yeah, our engineer just said llama tacos. Hello.
Yeah, I mean, if you came to La Paz, I would probably take you out to a nice restaurant and suggest that you order the llama steak.
Yum.
Wow.
Which is delicious. I think sometimes tastes a little bit slightly gamey, like venison. It's really, it's very low in cholesterol. Like it's like a much leaner meat than beef, for instance. The way that peasants eat llama is usually as jerky, which actually comes from the Quechua word charqui. And that's the most common way that llama meat's consumed in Bolivia, dried, salted, cured meats. I think there's certainly the possibility for opening, greater export markets. I'm not sure that it really, gets at the root.
Is there a non-World Bank sanctioned answer to that question?
Well, I think I probably just gave it to you.
No, but the one that isn't sanctioned by the World Bank. I mean, is there a response for what people outside the production zone of quinoa can do that supports positive change?
Sorry, I was trying to sort of circle your question. I'll just go straight to the point. I think one of the I think the least satisfying answer, but I think the most important answer that I give to people is to, recover the diversity and the nutrition in your own local food systems. I mean, that's always, I think, the most important thing that we can do, because I think we have, what we're seeing is like some real like north-south, you know, power dynamics here where we've, you know, we've emptied our own food system of its nutrition. And then we, you know, because we have the privilege to do that, we can import it from elsewhere. So there's sort of like, to me, a very kind of crass north-south kind of colonial, neocolonial sort of power dynamic there. But then, of course, you would say, well, you know, through fair trade and all of these things, aren't we, you know, helping quinoa farmers by creating a market? And there, I guess, I would also say, you know, that the focus on export markets and programs of the World Bank and other aid agencies and governments also, the Bolivian government in its agricultural development focuses almost exclusively on export markets, without looking at all of the ways in which local markets have been destroyed or undermined and could be rebuilt. And so, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, I think, everywhere on, like, how do we rebuild our local markets and push for the political will for, you know, the support needed to do that. But then, you know, the more satisfying answer that I can give is to look for the quinoa brands that support producers associations. And so, you know, a couple off the top of my head are Andean Naturals and Alter Eco in the U.S. There, you know, there are many others, and there are many others in Europe. But they work explicitly with, for instance, ANAPQI, which is the National Association of Quinoa Producers. It's about 2,000 members, the largest producer association. And they function essentially as a cooperative to ensure that the benefits are distributed fairly. They also have extension programs around, you know, biological pest control and soil conservation, trying to, you know, get the best prices for their members, you know, even providing like low or no interest credit for llama production. The Quinoa Association also does that. You know, the quinoa cooperatives, the producers' cooperatives, have lost a lot of the market share. They used to be, you know, 100% of the market, ANAPQI. Then, you know, in the late 90s, the producers' associations were probably had 70% or so control over the quinoa market. And now that sort of, or at least as of 2 years ago, it may be even less now, they had control over 30%, with 70% controlled by, you know, private sector, you know, private companies who make production contracts with individual farmers.
Right.
You know, where there's a lot less, you know, solidarity, concern about that sector is really much more interested in produce as much as possible, like fast and furious, before, you know, to try to fulfill the demand, which they've been playing catch up to try to fulfill for the last, you know, 5 years.
So now that there's a new quinoa TEF and another new TEF coming after that, and quinoa demand in the sort of global north is stabilized at a pretty high level, I would say, compared to, you know, 15 years ago. Is there a possibility where in a place like Bolivia, you get a quinoa price that works for farmers in a non-boom sense? It's not like dragging people in to buy tractors and invest money and sell their herds of llamas, but it's sort of working in a sense where there's profitability, but that is also in reach of consumers in Bolivia. Like I understand from you that the idea that farmers weren't able to afford their own quinoa was way overblown, but there was a sense in which urban residents in those countries were, you know, priced out of the market for a lot of people. And, you know, I think we should clarify that before the quinoa boom, there was very little consumption in the cities, right? Because it just didn't make its way to the cities. so much.
Right.
But so is there a possibility that, you know, going back to your answer just a second ago about building local markets everywhere, could quinoa become a staple for urban residents in the cities of the Andes in a way that works for farmers there?
Yeah, I am completely hopeful that it could. And there's a lot of, you know, small kind of efforts to try to promote that. And then there's also, you know, like there's some groups, like sort of public health groups who are working on using quinoa as a way to improve nutrition among the urban poor who are suffering, you know, as they are in many parts of the world. And, you know, Raj has written about this, called it the stuffed and starved phenomena, but there's rising rates of obesity and diet-related disease, you know, and type 2 diabetes in Bolivian cities, and even increasingly in rural towns. So there are groups working on, you know, trying to introduce quinoa as a healthier option. And, you know, possibly, you know, the decline in prices helps them to do that. Of course, it's really easy to put the toothpaste back in the tube of dietary change. So, you know, probably requires some larger scale investment in nutrition education and in not subsidizing the foods that are horrible for you. I mean, you know, we talk about the subsidies for GMO soy and corn in the U.S., and it's like a very similar situation in Bolivia, where the GMO soy growers capture all of the subsidies from the state and are increasingly, you know, penetrating local and domestic markets, so that and you can see it when you look at like food subsidy packages, where, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, like, well, why doesn't the state just buy quinoa from the farmers and include it in its food subsidy packages, which the state actually does do. But when you look at one of these things, it's like one bag of, like, small bag of quinoa, like a, you know, pound or something, and then you get, for, like, a month, 4 bottles of vegetable oil and like 3 bags of sugar and like another, you know, 3 bags of flour and rice and, you know, all of the agribusiness products. And, you know, and often because poor families need money, what they do is they take that, the quinoa, and they sell it and they monetize it. And then, you know, like, gringas like me who live in La Paz go to the market and buy the, you know, the informal market and buy their quinoa, or, you know, more affluent consumers. So it's a very difficult bind. And I think, you know, it requires some real political will, because it's not an easy thing to change people's diets, you know, requires a sort of multi-front strategy of education and, you know, renegotiating trade agreements and, you know, providing support for farmers for, you know, sustainable production. So all of those things right now are happening in kind of a disorganized way. So yeah, I'm hopeful that it's possible, and a lot of people are advocating for that. You know, I think one of the main takeaways is just to be a little bit weary, you know, the new hot superfood that's not only healthy and gluten-free and, you know, it's also solving poverty and hunger all over the world. And, you know, I think to be really weary of those kinds of claims, especially as we're constantly seeing these new things come up, you know, and like Teff or Fonio and Acai and Maca. And, you know, it's really an onslaught of superfood. So, like, just be grounded in trying to fix your own food system and and looking into how you can be in solidarity with other people trying to do the same all over the world, you know, beyond just buying their coffee or buying their product.
Well, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. It was great.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you.
Great talking
to you.
Bye. Bye.
Likewise.
Bye.
Tanya Kirsten is a research coordinator at Food First and author of Grabbing Power, The New Struggles for Land, Food, and Democracy in Northern Honduras. You've been listening to The Secret Ingredient with Raj Patel, Tom Philpott, and me, Rebecca McEnroy. You can find more information and links to Tanya Kirsten's work on our website, thesecretingredient.org. While you're there, check out some of our archive shows where we dig into all kinds of ingredients, like sugar with the late Sydney Mintz or bananas with Cynthia Enloe. Coming up next time on The Secret Ingredient, we'll talk with anthropologist Ajuna Patarai about food and nationalism, imagination, the future as cultural fact, and so much more. Subscribe to The Secret Ingredient in iTunes to never miss an episode, and leave us a review while you're there. It really helps us out a lot. Finally, you can find details on how you can support this show and all the great programming and podcasts that KUT Radio provides at KUT.org. The Secret Ingredient is engineered by David Alvarez and produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas.